Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. For the first time in a quarter century, some medical experts are proposing to change the way Alzheimer's is diagnosed. Tools such as brain scans and spinal fluid analysis can, they say, alert doctors and their patients to the onset of the disease before any symptoms are evident. Joining me to discuss the pros and cons of early diagnosis of Alzheimer's, Bridget Reynolds of the Memory Disorders Program at Georgetown University Medical Center, and Lori Ryan of the National Institute on Aging at the National Institutes for Health. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're joined at a studio at Washington University in St. Louis by Dr. John Morris, a professor of neurology there. Dr. Morris, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And from Cleveland, Sanjay Plimplikar, Associate Professor at the Cleveland Clinic's Lerner Research Institute. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Susan.
We invite our listeners to also join our conversation later in this hour. We'll take your calls at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org or send us a message on Facebook or Twitter. Well, John Morris, you helped formulate these new guidelines. Tell us how Alzheimer's is currently diagnosed and what the proposed changes would be.
Well, I think the proposed changes represent new knowledge gained over the 25 years since the original set of criteria were developed, and they allow physicians to capitalize on diagnosing the illness in the earliest possible stage, a stage called mild cognitive impairment. We've learned that many such early cases actually are due to underlying Alzheimer's disease. The new criteria also help give physicians confidence that Alzheimer's disease is the process responsible for the cognitive change. And one way that that added confidence can be obtained is through the use of biomarkers, as you indicated earlier.
And do you think, in your view, this is a good thing that the earlier you can diagnose Alzheimer's, the better?
I think there's a general consensus in the field that the earlier we're able to diagnose, the less overall brain damage there is, and hopefully then treatments, those we have currently available, but even more promising treatments to come, might have better efficacy, better benefit, the earlier they are begun.
Now, Lori Ryan, tell us, what was the role of the National Institutes of Health in devising these proposed new guidelines?
Right. This actually began in the spring of 2009. It's a joint venture between the NIA, the National Institute on Aging of the NIH, and the Alzheimer's Association. It's come clear that the early original criteria were from 1984, that we've learned a lot, as Dr. Morris said, in that time about the underlying pathology of the disease. And the idea is, can we move forward so that we can diagnose earlier? You know, we wanted to have criteria. And again, I think it's important to point out that these are guidelines, and there's going to be a whole process where the biomarkers are going to have to be validated before they would be used clinically, you know, in a community setting. But right now, we want to try to get the research done so we can validate the biomarkers to understand who's at the earliest stages of the disease, and then when we have drugs, can we intervene, as Dr. Moore said, before there's major damage and we can't do anything to stop the process or slow the process.
Now, these tests like brain scans or spinal taps, MRIs, who would have them in the effort to diagnose Alzheimer's at an early stage?
Well, ultimately, right now, they're research criteria, and predominantly they would be used at the specialty center, say the Alzheimer's disease centers and things. They wouldn't be used in a doctor's office right now because they still need to be validated in a community setting. So we need more research to make sure that these line up with the process that we think we see clinically, because we know by the time someone gets the cognitive changes, the memory and the other thinking and reasoning skill changes, that the disease process has been going on probably for a decade before. If you think about it, it's the analogies with cardiovascular disease, where we know that high cholesterol, high blood pressure, hypertension are risk factors for someone having a heart attack and atherosclerosis. The idea for eventually with Alzheimer's, we would be able to do the same thing, be able to have biomarkers in place once they're validated, and then know who is at risk. And, you know, hopefully we have treatments that are being tested now that are targeting the underlying pathology. We'd be able to intervene sooner.
Sanjay Pimplikar, do you think this is a good idea?
Yeah, in fact, broadly speaking, we are on the same side of the issue. My only concern is, I think these tools, either say early detection or the biomarkers, are wonderful as research tool, as both my panel members have just indicated, but they are not yet ready to be translated into clinical practice, and we can go into more details later. But overall, these are great research tools, but they are not yet ready to be given into the public.
Well, now, why not? If someone wants to undergo these tests to see if they might be at risk or that they have this disease, even though they have no symptoms yet, what would be the problems with going ahead and having them?
That's a good point. So I have three concerns. The first thing is these biomarkers, say PET scan or MRI, are fairly expensive. And so the question comes, who's going to pay for it? And, you know, we have now something like 35 million people above 65 years, and they all will be available or ready for these tests. So that's going to add a large expense either to the healthcare or to people. The second thing is, even if we use this information, your physician is not going to be able to use the information to change the course of treatment because there is none. And so it's not as if there's a drug available and we just want to catch patients early on. And third concern is, you know, if you look at the other diseases, for example, the prostate-specific antigen, as soon as the tool became available, we started to over-diagnose and over-treat people. And I think we run a risk of doing the same in Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. Morris, of the people who would have these biomarkers indicating onset of Alzheimer's, even though you don't have any symptoms yet, do all of them develop full-blown Alzheimer's later?
Well, that's exactly where we are now in the field, is trying to determine if people will go on and develop the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease and what are the factors that may determine how fast that dementia or those cognitive symptoms appear. So this is an active area of research.
Bridget, you work with families, patients, Alzheimer's patients and their families. What do you think the attitude is toward the idea of early diagnosis? How do you think they would react?
I think that there's under recognition of the importance of early diagnosis when working with families. And I think part of the challenge for clinicians is to help families to begin to learn how to identify when the process is beginning and to educate them about the importance of early diagnosis, because researchers believe that if treatments are initiated early on, they're most likely to be effective.
What kind of treatments would you do if you had early onset of Alzheimer's? What kind of treatments are you talking about?
As was mentioned, there are no treatments available for mild cognitive impairment, which is considered to be a prodromal or by most to be the earliest stage of Alzheimer's disease. But the treatments that we're researching, that we're looking for a disease-modifying effect, in addition to this, we have medications that offer symptomatic benefit. Those treatments, we believe, if they're initiated earlier on, will be most beneficial.
And when you're dealing with a patient and his or her family, and they get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, maybe it's after been some time trying to search for a diagnosis, are they relieved or alarmed, or what kind of reaction do they typically have?
Reactions are mixed. My personal belief is that awareness of a diagnosis is empowering. When people are aware of what they're dealing with, they can take action and begin planning for how they're going to manage their lives within the context of this disease. I think most often, depending on the way that the diagnosis is delivered, there's a sense of relief that there's acknowledgement of, yes, there is something going on, and then now, you know, what should we be doing about it?
Lori Ryan, tell me about the trends with Alzheimer's. Is the numbers of people who have it, are those numbers growing?
Sure, absolutely, because the number one risk factor still is age. And we know that our population is steadily aging. We're going to have more and more people, you know, over the age of 65. The estimates are something like when you get to the 85 and plus range that almost 50% of individuals may have a form of dementia, not just Alzheimer's. So it's a clearly growing problem as our population ages. And we need to be able to do something. It's going to impact not only burden on families, but also in terms of our healthcare system, and the economic costs will be huge as more and more people develop this disease.
Well, John Morris, if we go to this early diagnosis, those numbers would really mushroom, right? Because there'd be a lot of people who we would say have the onset of Alzheimer's, although you wouldn't see it except by looking at these biomarkers.
That's true, but I think the ultimate hope is that the new drugs that are in development now may be most beneficial when they're given even prior to the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. That is, we would change from trying to cure people who have dementia to also trying to prevent the dementia from occurring. Now, that's not right around the corner, but that's certainly the way the field and the science is going, and I think offers really great promise for the future.
Before we take a short break, are you optimistic about the development of drugs that might prevent Alzheimer's, alter its course? I'm sure it's been so frustrating that these drugs aren't available now.
It has been very frustrating, many of the trials in people who already have the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, the dementia of Alzheimer's disease, have simply shown that the drugs we've tried haven't worked. It may be that the drugs themselves are not good, but I think an even better opportunity would be if we could intervene earlier before there's irreversible brain damage. We would have a chance that the drugs might work and actually halt the onset of the symptoms.
Dr. John Morris, he's a professor of neurology and director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. Our phone line's now open, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking now in this hour about a proposal for guidelines that would allow for the earlier diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And I'm joined in the studio by Lori Ryan from the NIH and Bridget Reynolds from Georgetown University Medical Center. On the phone, we've got Sanjay Pimplekar, who's at the Cleveland Clinic, and John Morris at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to Wichita, Kansas, and talk to Anne. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Hi. I work with the mentally handicapped population here in Wichita. And in school, I've been researching Alzheimer's and dementia and such like that. Why is it so? It just seems more prevalent in the population I work with. And it also seems to not be as acknowledged as much. What's being done for our people, and why are we not being advocated for? I know it's, you know, adults in nursing homes are being taken care of and looked at and studied and such, but our population with Down syndrome and MR and such like that, they're just essentially ignored, and it's not acknowledged in them.
Do you mean not acknowledge that they have Alzheimer's disease?
I'm sorry?
Do you mean that it's not as acknowledged that they have Alzheimer's disease?
It's harder to diagnose, mm-hmm. and they just blame, oh, well, they're MR. And it's not after they die and they do autopsies, they find, oh, in fact, yes, they are MR, or they do have Down syndrome, but they also had Alzheimer's or dementia, and it's more or less seen as an oops.
Oh, I see. Well, and that's an interesting point. Lori Ryan, what do you think?
Actually, that's a great point. We actually do know that individuals with Down syndrome are at a greater risk of developing Alzheimer's disease as they age. And they are being studied, actually, currently. We have a couple of clinical trials that are looking at Alzheimer's disease, specifically treating Alzheimer's and actually trying to prevent some of the symptoms of Alzheimer's in individuals with Down syndrome. But I think you're right. It's not as recognized widely, but the researchers are actually looking at this population.
All right. Good to know. From Durham, North Carolina, let's talk to Karen. Karen, you're on the air. Thanks for holding on.
Thank you. I wanted to comment on the need to educate doctors first to identify the symptoms. A lot of I'm sure that more than the one I experienced don't identify even the initial factors that are affecting the person. I had the experience of a general practitioner with my mother. I was a very long distance caregiver, and when I went to the doctor with her, and she had she then said a lot of things that didn't happen in that meeting, like I hadn't allowed her to talk, he had never come in the room, et cetera, et cetera. And I told the doctor that, and he laughed at me. And he said, well, she didn't have enough points or few enough points to on their 30-point scale to be identified as having Alzheimer's, and he wouldn't even give me a reference to get her evaluated. And I had to go through all kinds of back doors, long distance, to get her an evaluation, because if I talked to her about it, she would throw the book at me. I mean, it was impossible to deal with her. So it had to all be done in secret and sneaky ways to get her to a doctor who immediately, knowing the field, within 5 minutes, just nodded at me as to say, yeah, well, that's what we've got. We've got Alzheimer's here.
You know, Karen, we're so sorry to hear about your experience. Bridget Reynolds, you deal as the clinical care coordinator in the memory disorders program at Georgetown University Medical Center with this all the time. Do you find that doctors, general practitioners, and others still need some education?
I certainly do. Part of the problem is the amount of time that general practitioners have to evaluate patients. So they're often restricted to under 20 minutes or even under 10. The process of diagnosis at our clinic, a new patient evaluation takes an hour and a half. And so it's time constraints. There is a need for more education. And this also points to the need for better diagnostic tools. We don't have any, for instance, for high blood pressure, you can put a blood pressure cuff on and give a diagnosis of hypertension. Well, the development of biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease will help give us tools to make diagnosis easier.
And what would you advise someone like Karen who finds himself really wanting a more sophisticated diagnosis and having trouble getting through, you know, what is often a gatekeeper now with our insured system to getting, so what can they do?
One thing they can certainly do is contact the local chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, where they should be able to obtain referrals for clinicians who specialize in dementia research.
Sanjay Pimplekar, can you tell us, do we understand now what causes Alzheimer's?
Oh, that will take another show to talk about everything we know about Alzheimer's. Fact is, the bottom line is, no, we really, I hate to say this, but, you know, we have clues what might be causing Alzheimer's, but we don't really have a defined cause that we know of. In the field right now, the prevailing hypothesis is this amyloid that deposits in the brain that can be seen by the PET scanning that is the cause of the disease. Many people believe in it, but there is also increasing evidence that not all cases of Alzheimer's can be explained by these depositions.
Dr. Morris, has Alzheimer's been particularly hard to figure out the causes of, figure out how to treat it? It seems like we've made such progress addressing some other diseases, and yet the progress on Alzheimer's seems so slow.
Well, I think there are a couple considerations. First, we see the Alzheimer's disease process in the brain when people come to autopsy at the end stage of the illness. I think the promise of some of these new biomarkers is they're going to allow us to see the pathologic changes, the lesions of the disease in living people. We won't have to wait for the autopsy, and we can see how they create difficulty for the person in terms of their cognitive and functional ability. So I think that biomarkers, we're talking a lot about them in this show, but they will give us great promise for identifying people who have the brain changes, perhaps even before the symptoms occur. But the new proposed criteria to help doctors diagnose the illness, and I absolutely agree with what's been said. It's been estimated that perhaps 50% of people with Alzheimer's dementia in the United States are unrecognized by their physician, so there is a huge need to improve the diagnosis. I think these new criteria are quite flexible. They don't require biomarkers. Biomarkers can be used to help confirm the diagnosis, but the new criteria focus on, is the person declining in his or her cognitive abilities compared to where they once were? And the new criteria are flexible enough that healthcare providers who don't have access to biomarkers can improve their diagnostic accuracy.
Now, these new guidelines are proposed. Lori Ryan, what happens next with them?
Well, actually, there's a comment period right now where the community, the medical and scientific community, can actually weigh in on the criteria, or on the guidelines, rather, and that's actually available through the Alzheimer's Association website. Ultimately, after the comments come in, they will be guidelines will be revised, and they will actually be published in a peer-reviewed journal. And then the idea is that these guidelines will go out into particularly the research community to look at the biomarkers and try to validate them in terms of looking at the course of the disease. So, I mean, I think it's going to help clinicians in terms, as Dr. Morris said, with better awareness of the clinical criteria, the cognitive changes. I mean, some of the changes from the earlier criteria are a greater awareness of what some of the differential diagnoses are. Alzheimer's is not the only cause of dementia. It's the primary cause in people over the age of 65. But there are other things. Also, it doesn't always present with memory as the first complaint. That's generally the case, but there may be other cognitive changes. And so trying to have physicians be more aware of these other aspects of the clinical changes that are seen will help clarify the diagnosis for the community, but then the criteria or the guidelines can be used by the researchers to actually validate the biomarker. So eventually the goal is that we'd like to have these biomarkers available for use, but we need to validate them first.
All right, let's go to Bruce. He's calling us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Bruce, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I actually wanted to get back to a question you had posed to Dr. Morris about the progress in Alzheimer's disease and developing new treatments. I'm in New Mexico. I'm an Alzheimer's disease researcher, actually a colleague of Dr. Pimplicar's, and I'm riding my bicycle with Dr. Lee Ryan, another Alzheimer's disease researcher, to Albuquerque this afternoon. And the main reason we're doing this, we're actually biking across the entire country as part of an Alzheimer's breakthrough ride. And we're riding because we actually need to have more investment in Alzheimer's disease research. For those of your listeners, Alzheimer's disease research has been underinvested in the past decade compared to any other of the common diseases. And this is something that's now sort of at a crisis point in terms of the numbers of people that we're going to be seeing developing Alzheimer's disease in the next 20 or 30 years. So we want to bring attention to the disease, but also to try to get a particular act that's before Congress right now called the Alzheimer's Breakthrough Act, which will raise funding for $2 billion a year for Alzheimer's disease research. So I just wanted to bring this up because I think it's really important that the listeners know that right now we're sort of an underinvestment in Alzheimer's disease research.
All right, Bruce, thanks so much for your call. How do you compare investment in research in different kinds of disease? For instance, earlier this week on the Diane Rehm Show, we did an hour about bladder cancer. And advocates for people who have had bladder cancer said their disease, research into their disease, was underfunded and they wanted to increase funding for it. Is there objective ways, Lori Ryan, to compare the investment, maybe particularly the government investment that's being made in different diseases?
Well, I think that is absolutely difficult. Those of us in the funding agencies, you know, obviously we work very hard within our own diseases to get the best research done with the funds that we have, but always there's more research needed. So there are competing interests, and it's a very difficult question. I don't think there are easy answers to that.
There's no place people can go to see. I guess you'd have to compare how often the disease occurs, how much money it gets, and so on. Is there any place that does that?
Well, certainly the NIH, you can actually look at what the investment that the NIH itself makes. The NIH main webpage has something called Report, where you can go in and put, you know, Alzheimer's, and you can see what's being funded by the NIH for Alzheimer's disease. And you can see it for other diseases as well. So people can certainly see what we're doing in terms of the NIH funding.
John Morris, how much difference? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can I jump in for 1 minute? Here's another way to think about Alzheimer's disease. I believe that it's the fourth leading cause of death in the United States. Now, the statistics won't support that because rarely is Alzheimer's disease listed on the death certificate. It's usually pneumonia or some other complication that occurs in the end stage of Alzheimer's. But if I'm right, if it's the fourth leading cause of death, we can think of it this way. The three other leading causes of death, heart disease, cancer, and stroke, we know people who have had a heart attack and survived. We know people who have cancer and are survived or in remission. We know people who have stroke and have recovered, but we don't know a single person with Alzheimer's disease who has recovered or survived. This is a serious illness. It is deadly. It shortens life. And I can't agree more with the breakthrough writer in Albuquerque about the need to invest in research so we can defeat this devastating illness.
Sanjay Pimplekar.
Yeah. You know, Susan, you're absolutely right. 2 days ago when Dr. Schoenberg was on and he was talking about bladder cancer and how underinvested it is. So, you know, we get a feeling that each time a scientist comes on the phone, we are always asking for more money for our cause. And people do get a little bit fatigued. But so let me just give you one idea that the Alzheimer's disease has cost the U.S. economy last year $172 billion. NIA, that suppose the bulk of Alzheimer's research had spent $464 million. So to translate that into our household bills, that means you pay heating bill up to $350 per month and spend $1 insulating your house. Now, doesn't it make sense to put more money investing, insulating your house so that your heating bill comes down? So it's absolutely right. Bruce, who's in Arizona, and John in WashU, we all agree that we need more investment. But just going to public and telling them, you know, give us more money, it's sort of, you know, people do get fatigued afterwards. So scientists need to use a different approach to make people more aware.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Lewis, Delaware, and talk to Michael. Michael, hi.
Hi. Yes, I've been listening to this. My wife has what I would call a mild cognitive impairment or short-term memory loss. And the doctor has never said the word Alzheimer's. However, she's taking Aricept and a medical food called Exana. And I went to a seminar recently for Alzheimer's caregivers, and they said that 40% of the people who have this mild cognitive impairment will develop into Alzheimer's. But what about the other 60%? Is this something that could be with her for a long time, or is this my expectation is that it could turn into Alzheimer's? They also talked about vitamin B12 and thyroid exam to see if that may have some connection with her memory loss.
All right. Michael, we're sorry to hear about your wife's condition. We hope things go well. Hard to do diagnosis on the radio, but John Morris, can you respond to Michael's question?
So I think this mild cognitive impairment can be caused by multiple factors. In most cases, not 40%, I would say higher, most cases, it is underlying Alzheimer's disease, and these proposed new criteria will help physicians gain some confidence if the mild cognitive impairment actually is due to Alzheimer's disease. But I think the essential point is whenever there's been a decline in an individual in their mental abilities and it's beginning to interfere with how they're able to conduct their everyday life, that person needs to have a thorough evaluation. One, because it's not always Alzheimer's. Even in the mild cognitive impairment stage, there may be other factors such as low thyroid, as your wife was evaluated. But if it is likely due to Alzheimer's, then the current therapies can be initiated. And most importantly, we can talk with not only the family, but also the patient about their future wishes, who will care for them if they become incapacitated, what they would like for their living situation. The patient can be involved in that planning for the future.
Michael, thanks so much for your call. We're going to take another very short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Alzheimer's disease, the latest hopes for treatment, and the new diagnostic tools that doctors may have soon. And we'll go back to the phones and take some of your calls. Our line, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Federal prosecutors have charged 16 current and former New Orleans police officers for shootings and cover-ups in the days after Hurricane Katrina. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with investigative journalist A.C. Thompson of ProPublica, who has been investigating these shootings as well as alleged hate crimes committed by a white militia. Join us.
We have an emailer who writes us, "Our family is new to this journey as caregivers to a person with Alzheimer's disease. Dad is 84, presently showing moderate cognitive difficulties. We are in the process of deciding if he should participate in a clinical trial. It appears that the benefit would not be to him or even to his children, as useful application is years down the road. However, it has the potential to benefit his decisions, descendants, and others who may struggle with Alzheimer's. This is a hard decision to make." Bridget, I know you deal with families thinking about clinical trials. What's your perspective?
Well, I had wanted to make the comment earlier that in addition to the need for more funding for Alzheimer's research, there is also a need for increased public awareness about the availability of clinical trials. While it is true that there may be no direct benefit to patients through participation, because we don't, of course, know whether these treatments that are under research will, in fact, have a positive disease-modifying effect, there is no way to move forward and develop new treatments unless people participate in the trials. So direct benefit, maybe not, but possibly, and benefit overall to advance our knowledge and understanding of treatment for Alzheimer's disease, definitely. It's the only way we can move forward.
And when you talk to families facing this same difficult decision as the person who emailed us, what kind of reaction do you find typical? Do they typically say, it's going to help down the road, we want to participate? Or do they say, my only concern is my father and his well-being, his comfort?
Well, reactions are certainly mixed. I think every person that enrolls in the clinical trial hopes for direct benefit to the patient. But most people are also motivated by, you know, a desperate need to find better treatments or disease-modifying treatments for Alzheimer's disease.
And Lori Ryan, if there's someone who's suffering from Alzheimer's or has a family member who is interested in clinical trials, what could they do?
Oh, absolutely. The NIA actually has the Alzheimer's Disease Education and Referral Center, and I'll give you the 800 number for that, which is 1-800-438-4380, or email to ADEAR, A-D-E-A-R, at NIA.nih.gov, where they can go and find information about the disease as well as participating in trials. The Alzheimer's Association also has a new registry called I think it's called Trial Match, where you can actually sign up to receive information about specific clinical trials. So taking a look at the Alzheimer's Association website, I think the ADEAR and Alzheimer's Association are the best two places to go for information about clinical trials, what may be available in your area.
Here, go ahead, Bridget.
And also I would add the Alzheimer's Disease Cooperative Study, holding a large amount of federal funding for Alzheimer's-related research, clinical trial research. And that's the website would be adcs.org.
Right.
Here's an email from Sharon. She writes us from Dallas. She says, with no cure discovered yet and no helpful treatments available, a diagnosis mainly serves to endanger the person for insurance discrimination and many more years than necessary of the horrid misery of believing every day that your mind is disappearing piece by piece. Both my parents have suffered with this special torture since 1998 and 2001. I cannot imagine why any sane person would want to increase the years they know that they are disappearing. The drugs in use for treatment are not worth the expense, as far as our family can tell, although we desperately tried them. I strongly believe only pharmaceutical companies will benefit from earlier diagnosing. John Morris, what would you say to Sharon?
Well, I don't think there's any question that rendering a diagnosis can have adverse effects on insurability at younger ages, even employability, and ultimately on everyday activities such as driving. Some states, when the diagnosis is made, automatically revoke driving privileges for an individual. So there can be adverse effects to the diagnosis. However, I would say that the benefits outweigh the potential adverse effects. As we heard Bridget say earlier, nobody wants to hear that they have Alzheimer's disease, but more often than not, patients and families are relieved to hear that there is a reason that they are experiencing their symptoms. It's not something that they're made up or it's in their mind. They actually have a disease, and now that it's recognized, they can move ahead and do the necessary planning. And also, I think that we underestimate how well people can deal with getting a diagnosis and then contributing to some of the research efforts that have been discussed here today in an effort to fight this disease. So I think the benefits do outweigh the potential adverse effects.
And we have several emailers asking what to keep this information out of the hands of employers or insurance companies. Sanjay Plimplikar, would this information be available in that way that might hurt people who are still working, for instance?
I cannot answer that question directly because that depends on the legal and the medical professionals. But I just want to chime in that I have received several emails sort of explaining the same sentiments as Sharon did, that right now it's too early to start labeling people with Alzheimer's disease. And you have heard from John Morris and other people that, you know, how advantageous the biomarkers can be or how advantageous early detection can be. But that's just the one side of the coin. The second side of the coin that we don't talk about is early detection can also lead to the false positives. There are a number of cases in different diseases we know that as sensitive the measure gets, we also have a large number of people who will show the symptoms but never go on to developing the disease. And so that just adds the burden. And we need to, you know, temper our enthusiasm for these biomarkers or for this high expensive test and come up with a diagnosis for which we really don't have any result. And the good example, very briefly, was MRI and the back pain. So in the beginning, we thought, oh, MRIs are great. And now we realize that people do show abnormalities in their spinal column without absolutely no symptoms of back pain. And so now even the American Pain Society and College of Physicians, they recommend against making MRIs for back pain.
Dr. Morse, how would you respond to Sanjay Plimplikar about this point?
Well, I hate to disagree, but I will slightly. I think that there always is a risk of overdiagnosis, that's certain. But I think the biomarkers will be helpful in two ways. It will help practicing physicians have confidence that the cognitive changes that their patients are experiencing are due to Alzheimer's disease. As you've heard Dr. Ryan indicate, there are other potential causes of dementia. So it's important to have an evaluation and have an accurate diagnosis. Second, as Dr. Ryan also has indicated, the biomarkers give us great promise for looking at the brain changes of Alzheimer's disease in living people. We don't have to wait for the autopsy. We can look and see if some of the new therapies are actually diminishing the amount of brain lesions that are visible because of some of the new imaging technologies or some of the new spinal fluid assays. This is the most promising type of research that we have in the Alzheimer area today.
Lori.
Yes, I'd like to add, though, as well, that, you know, certainly the biomarkers, as John pointed out, as Dr. Morse pointed out, are critical, but they're not ready for prime time. I think that's a point that we need to make to people, that we're not saying that you're going to go to your physician's office and have a spinal tap or to get CSF or, you know, MRI things at this point. But we do, because we do still need to validate the markers, and that's where the research comes in. But we need the criteria so we can look and validating these biomarkers. We need the new guidelines. And certainly for clinical trials, they are critical because right now it takes years to do a clinical trial because the cognitive symptoms are very slow moving in Alzheimer's disease. And so we see very small changes over time in cognition. Well, that's very difficult to see movement when you're trying to have one group that's being treated and one that's not, you know, placebo, as we call it. The biomarkers will allow us to track progression, I think, better and make our trials more efficient. And hopefully we will find out sooner whether or not a drug is working and whether it's not working, and also for whom it may work. There may be some people that the drug will work for and some that won't. There's some evidence that there's a genetic marker called ApoE4. Some people are positive for it, some are negative, and it looks like maybe some of the drugs may work better for someone who's negative as opposed to positive, and so on. So we're really trying to tease this out. So the biomarkers, in addition to early detection, are also going to be critical for our evaluating new therapies.
Now, if the biomarkers are validated in clinical trials, as you say, could there be a day in the not-so-distant future where someone goes for their annual checkup and biomarkers for Alzheimer's are a routine part of the process?
Well, ultimately, we'd like to have a biomarker or a panel of biomarkers that we could, when we suspect someone or someone may be at risk, that we can do. So, you know, wouldn't want to say not too distant future because they do have to be validated. But absolutely, we want to have something like the cardiovascular field has, as I pointed out, like cholesterol and other markers. So we are moving towards having that ability.
Let's talk to Lisa. She's calling us from Rockville, Maryland. Lisa, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I'm 51 years old. I think I'm doomed. I'm already noticing that I'm not as sharp as I used to be. The earlier caller, whose wife had short-term memory loss and is now on Aricept, excuse me, I keep hearing the phrase early detection, early detection. Would she have benefited from an earlier treatment of, say, Aricept or something else? In other words, is there something I can start to do now? Because I'm really sure that I'm doomed.
You're sure you're doomed because you think you have Alzheimer's disease?
No, I think that I will. I think that it is in my destiny to have some sort of vascular dementia or Alzheimer's or, you know, basically cognitive limitations. And must one wait until the until the evidence starts to become unquestionable? Or is there something other than crossword puzzles, you know, and staying fit and having a good diet, all of which I do because I'm terrified?
All right, Lisa, let's ask Dr. Morris. What do you think?
Well, I think Lisa is doing the recommendations to try to keep the brain healthy. I must say that staying engaged socially and physically active and mentally engaged are all potential ways to try to keep brain health as promising as it can be. But all of these lifestyle changes are yet unproven as to whether they can really halt the onset of Alzheimer's disease. I think she also mentioned a healthy diet, and it should be noted that things that are bad for the heart in middle age turn out to be bad for the brain decades later. So definitely controlling high blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes are important. But I think the main activities are to stay active and engaged and to continue to invest in, if you are at increased risk by dint of family history, to invest in and participate in research to see how we might be able to prevent the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease in coming years.
Sanjay Pimplekar, you've seen a whole business grow up around doing mental exercises, computer games that are sold to help help keep your brain healthy. What's the evidence that those work?
That's a good point. And I think I second when John said the lifestyle changes are important. But I think I'm more enthusiastic about lifestyle changes because if you look at all the epidemiological data, either in terms of the in the diet, in the exercise, in terms of your social interaction, these are really the strongest protective factors against Alzheimer's disease. So I'm not able to comment on, you know, whether this particular brain game or this particular crossword puzzle will it protect you or not. But it is definitely true that today, in the absence of any drug, and the only ones that we have are the symptomatic, they treat the symptoms, not the disease. So in the absence of any treatment, the only advice that, one of the advices that people should follow is the lifestyle changes. And can I just take one more minute and talk about when we say that all of our amyloid-directed drug trials have failed because we have started late, and that is a possibility. But one more possibility we should think about is the amyloid the only target that we should be studying? There is more and more evidence coming out that non-amyloid mechanisms also seem to be working for Alzheimer's. And I think we need to put more fires instead of just focusing on one.
All right. Lisa, thanks for your call. We hope you're not doomed. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's try to take another caller. We'll go to Diane. She's calling us from Florida. Hi, Diane.
Hello. My comment is regarding funding. And it seems as though that any disease doesn't really get the attention or the money, in particular the funding that it needs, unless it's been really affected by someone that's a superstar or some celebrity or something that's advocating, and it's all in your face so much, after that. If that person is diagnosed with it, for example, Ronald Reagan or something, and I'm particularly interested because I am going through taking care of a loved one now with Alzheimer's, and I've also registered to be in a memory study because, like the previous caller, I'm terrified that I'm doomed because of heredity and things that are going on in my life. And if you could just address the comment of the funding, does it really help when you have some superstar, some celebrity out there advocating for the disease?
Well, I wonder, to our panel, does it make a big difference? Did it make a difference, for instance, when Ronald Reagan was pretty open about the onset of Alzheimer's in his case? John Morris, what's your perspective?
I think when President Reagan and his family announced that he did have Alzheimer's disease in the 1990s, that was a very important step forward. It helped reduce the stigma that had been attached to the diagnosis. People had used terms such as senility or hardening of the arteries, but when they said he has Alzheimer's disease, then I think that was empowering for the field and helped people come forward and really accelerated the focus on the illness. And I do think that it's important for advocacy efforts, both at a grassroots level and organized through the Alzheimer's Association, to have celebrity spokespersons. That's always helpful. But more important is just to have individuals work together through Alzheimer's Association chapters, through research centers, through clinical trials, to have their voices heard that this is a terrible disease. It already is very costly, as Sanjay said, and with the rapidly aging population, it is going to overwhelm our healthcare system in the next 10 to 15 years. We must do something to defeat Alzheimer's disease.
Such a tough disease on so many families. Well, let me thank our panel for being with us, Dr. John Morse, Sanjay Pimplekar, Lori Ryan, Bridget Reynolds. Thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.